This is CSAP Science and Policy Podcast, where we're bringing you the latest evidence and expertise to improve public policy making. This week, we're proud to present the sixth episode in our series on science, policy, and pandemics, which is brought to you in partnership with Cambridge Infectious Diseases and the Cambridge Immunology Network. In this episode, our host, Dr. Rob Doubleday, is joined by Professor Sarah Jane Blakemore and Professor Paul Ramchandani.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Rob Doubleday from the Center for Science and Policy, and today on Science, Policy, and Pandemics, we're discussing how children and adolescents are faring during the pandemic. We're exploring their well-being and mental health and how they're learning. It's a pleasure for me to introduce our two speakers, Sarah Jane Blakemore, Professor of Psychology at Cambridge, whose work particularly focuses on cognition and decision-making and mental health of adolescents, and Paul Ramchandani, who has, I'm sure you will agree, one of the finest job titles. He is the Lego Professor of Play in the Faculty of Education, and Paul's work looks particularly at children's early development, the role of parenting, the role of play. And Paul is also a consultant psychiatrist in the NHS. And so, very warm welcome to you too. So if I might start with you, Paul, thinking particularly of younger children living through this pandemic, these uncertain and unsettling time, what do we know about how young children will be experiencing this, the social distancing, the restrictions and the anxieties that this pandemic will inevitably be causing?
Well, there's lots of speculation and lots of comment in newspapers and magazines, specifically about the effects of kind of quarantine and a pandemic. We know very little in terms of its impact on children's mental health. There haven't been that many studies that have been completed in terms of research in previous pandemics and previous episodes of quarantine. There's a little bit of work about post-traumatic stress disorder, but beyond that, there's not very much that's specifically about quarantine. But I guess we do know more generally from research and practice quite a lot about many of the other factors that are pertinent. And I guess one of the things that concerns me and a lot of other people as well is that some of the knock-on effects of quarantine and the pandemic are things that we know can be harmful for children's mental health. So I've written a tiny bit about this called kind of hidden effects, which aren't going to be equally distributed. There are going to be some children, some young people are going to be much more affected by this than others. Many young people will have higher levels of anxiety and maybe even higher levels of depressive symptoms at the moment, because they're isolated and away from things and they're worried. But for most young people, those effects will pass when they come out of quarantine or if we move on from this pandemic, assuming that we follow the course that looks likely that things will change for the better, hopefully sometime soon, already seems to be in some countries. But those kind of hidden effects are those children who are at home more in difficult environments, so environments where there might be domestic violence or there might be other aggravating factors which are difficult to live around. So those children in those situations, things are going to be more challenging. And looking ahead, and I'm not an economist, but the economists all seem to be predicting that this is going to be a really tough long-term economic time. And the effects of economic downturn on families are tough. And again, for those families that are most affected, so those where people lose income or have dramatic changes in their lifestyle that mean that life becomes more difficult, those are the children that I think we perhaps have to be most concerned about. So there are lots of gaps in our knowledge. Some of those will be being filled in the months ahead as research kind of ramps up on this topic. But there are things that we know from other research. And that's the thing that I suppose concerns me most, that there are groups of children who are going to have adverse effects on their mental health because of these other exposures.
So in terms of what governments should be doing now, or should be thinking about it in the medium and longer term, are there kind of first aid sort of steps or immediate steps that are being taken or should be taken to try and identify and look after the most vulnerable kids now, or is it more about being aware of the issues over the longer term and putting measures in place to try and mitigate some of those harms?
From where I sit, and this is mostly a UK perspective, I think there are some immediate things and there are some things that we can plan for. So we're struggling in child and adolescent mental health services in the NHS because we've had to shift over to an online way of working predominantly, and staff have been shifted around services. Health visiting staff have also been seconded into more acute roles. So some of the staff who might be expected to preventively pick up worries around domestic violence and difficulties at home aren't as available. The child and adolescent mental health services aren't able to see the throughput of children that we would see. So I guess focusing some attention on those normal services in social care and in health that have had to be slowed down for the time being, and thinking about how we ramp those up and how we change to these new ways of working as quickly and swiftly as possible is one way of hopefully at least offering services to children who are in difficulty. Finding ways of them being able to access them is a real challenge. And we've seen this across the health service that people aren't currently seeking help for physical and mental health problems as much as they normally do. So we need to try and turn that around. And then in the longer term, it's thinking about what we do about the economic effect on young people. And the last recession had a disproportionate effect on young people and families in poverty and a lot of children. I think something like a third of children in the UK ended up living in poverty at the end of the last decade. So there are things that the government can and others can do to think about those, mitigating those effects before they happen, because we know it's going to come, an economic downturn. How do we make sure, the challenge is how do we make sure it doesn't have a disproportionate effect on children and young people?
Great. Well, I'm sure we'll sort of come back to you, Paul. And Sarah Jane, can we turn to you? And your work's highlighted the kind of the specialness of adolescence. What does your research suggest about how adolescents will be experiencing the pandemic at the moment?
So we work on the development of the brain and development of cognition, and particularly social cognition in adolescents. We know that adolescents go through a huge amount of development, both socially and cognitively, and also in terms of their brains, right up until the 20s. Or even 30s. And the particular element of development that I'm interested in our research is the importance of the social environment and the development of the social brain. We know that adolescents go through a period of kind of peer reorientation, which means that they naturally become more distant from their families and more affiliated with their peers. This is a really important part of adolescence, because by the end of adolescence, you need to become an independent adult. You need to become independent from your parents, independent from your families. So you need to build up those peer relationships and peer affiliations and develop a kind of a stronger sense of self, particularly social self. That is how other people see you in your peer environment. We also know that if you deprive adolescents, this is actually mostly from animal research, if you deprive adolescents of social interaction, for example, through social isolation paradigms, that has a unique effect on, and quite a damaging effect on, the adolescent brain and behaviour, more harmful than the same kind of social isolation either before adolescence or in adulthood. So there's something special about brain development during adolescence and the need for social interaction with peers during that period of life. So my initial worry, like many people who work in my area, was, well, with these social distancing measures that have been brought in all around the world, what kind of effect will that have on adolescent development, that both their brain and cognitive development, but also their mental health, given that social interactions are so important. But actually thinking about it a lot, talking a lot with colleagues, and we also wrote a paper which we pre-printed last week on this, we thought, first of all, it's important to acknowledge that social distancing is not social isolation. Adolescents are normally living with their families in the lockdowns, so they're not alone. And also they have, many of them, at least in the UK, have access to social media. So they can continue social connections with their peers, which are hugely important, through their smartphones, through social media. And this is all an open question. You know, one of our questions which we want to look at is, does social interaction through social media, so virtual social interaction, does that provide sufficient social learning and social connection to mitigate the negative, potentially harmful effects of social distancing? So that's one of our hypotheses, especially in this generation of young people who've grown up with social media and mobile phones. On the other hand, what it does suggest, and this goes back to what Paul was saying, is that if social connections can be achieved through social media and smartphones, then we have to worry about the young people who don't have access to smartphones or social media because they can't afford smartphones, or they can't afford phone contracts or Wi-Fi or 3G, because they could be the ones who are really suffering and potentially very lonely during this period of social distancing.
Your research, I think, is correct in saying sort of points to this hypersensitivity or sensitivity of adolescents to their peers and their sort of belonging or reactions to their peers. And I think you've also commented on ways that can be harnessed, as it were, in these times, both sort of to when thinking about social distancing measures, but also in terms of engagement with education?
Yes. So so I've been talking about the importance of social connection and social interaction for adolescents, but a consequence of that is this heightened susceptibility to peer influence that we see in adolescents. So we know from many years of research that adolescents are particularly susceptible to peer influence. We mostly have researched this in the context of risk taking. So if you think about the risks that we sort of stereotypically worry about adolescents taking, like smoking or binge drinking or experimenting with drugs or dangerous driving, those are risks that adolescents, if they do take them, and not all do, they're much more likely to take them when they're with friends than when they're on their own. This is very well-known effect of peer influence on risk-taking. Peer influence can also have effects on positive pro-social behaviours. For example, we know that adolescents are more likely to volunteer their time or give to charity or help others or other pro-social behaviours if their friends do. Another element of this social distancing and lockdown and the fact that schools are closed is the concern that some children are getting a lot of kind of online learning, online teaching through their schools, and others aren't. And there's a huge amount of inequality there, partly through different schools having different levels of resource for this, but also through the young people themselves having different resources. Some young people don't have access to a laptop, for example, or Wi-Fi, which is necessary for this, for the online learning. And I know from many teachers I work with closely in schools in London, particularly, that there's very little engagement from young people in some schools in some areas. And the question is how to encourage that kind of engagement. And like Paul was saying, we don't know the answers to these things because we've never been in this situation before. But one prediction from the research on peer influence in adolescents and how important peers are to each other, and peers can really change each other's attitudes, is that if you encourage adolescents themselves to encourage each other to engage in school, that may have, the prediction is that that would have more effect than adults trying to encourage school engagement. Peers really listen to each other, and in some ways it's a way of sort of empowering young people to help each other and to encourage each other and to influence each other in positive behaviours like school engagement during lockdowns.
Are we developing a better understanding of the coping mechanisms and best practices that students and schools are developing during this time? Paul, do you have
only a very general response. I think it's a really important point. There are, I don't know how many dozens and hundreds of surveys being launched over the last few weeks and are over the next few weeks. So there'll be a lot of data. There'll be questions about how useful that data is, but there'll be a lot of data being collected. A lot of those studies are focused on problems. The ones I know about are obviously around mental and physical health. There are some that are more general. One of the things that is missing from a lot of them is children's voices. There are a lot of the ones of children certainly are asking parents' views, and engaging children in a meaningful way is more challenging. It's not impossible, but it's more challenging without direct contact. So I think it's a really important point. There will be some data being gathered on it, but it'll be a minority of the overall amount of data coming through. That's a really valid point.
I know schools that where their teaching has just become online teaching and they're getting 99% uptake engagement from pupils. And I know other schools where uptake is about 5% and where the teachers are spending most of their time in safeguarding. Doing safeguarding things like phoning families, phoning children, making sure they're okay, and there's just no time for trying to educate them. These are secondary schools tend to be not engaged in it, not motivated to get engaged, or the families just don't have the resources to get engaged. So again, disparities between schools is so acute right now, and being it's just very clear that some schools are dealing with it better than others for lots of different reasons. And I am surprised about the lack of cohesion between school groups, actually. But teachers are so squeezed. They're working harder than they ever have done right now to make sure, trying to work out how to teach online. We're also having that experience at universities for the first time. It takes a huge amount of time and effort. making sure the technology works, getting everything into a kind of online form, which is really hard for example, you know, science and practical lessons, for example, and art. So in some ways I'm surprised there isn't a kind of national group coordinating everything. On the other hand, I think teachers are just busier than they ever have been, and head teachers as well. So where would the time be for that?
How should policymakers and schools be thinking about the inequalities that are going to be building up at this time? How do vulnerable groups need to be thought about when kids come back to school?
And I guess it's thinking about what our priorities are, because the idea that schools can restart and do everything and get children to catch up and on their missed learning and also be ready for exams and also do all the other things that are necessary, I think is fanciful. I haven't seen much of a move yet towards that conversation, but hopefully that conversation will start to happen about what are our priorities. And it may be different in different countries and different settings. Thinking about children who perhaps on the edge, children who are on the edge of care, children who have disappeared from the school system effectively, and now the schools have a job to try and find them. And for some areas that will be fine, but for many areas there are large numbers of children who are in these kind of risk categories or risk groups or in risky situations that are going to take some tracking down and a lot of work to re-engage them with school. And some of those children, and this is a prediction, kind of based on research, but not specifically to this situation, that is those children, some of them will have the greatest difficulty in reintegrating and who may have the biggest challenges kind of psychologically in getting back into school and getting back into the routines of school. So I think there are questions about how much we prioritise our academic attainment at this current time, how much we prioritise getting things back to normal academically, and how much we prioritise the social and psychological well-being of children. And obviously it's not all one or another, but the values that we choose and the priorities that we select will dictate where we spend our energy. And there isn't going to be energy to do all of those things, not at the current time. There are kind of some practical issues around in response to the virus and how schools manage that, and social distancing and protecting children and teachers and other staff on top of that as well, which have to come into play.
One thing though I would say, this goes back to what I was saying right at the beginning, which is we know so much now, or so much more than we did, about how the brain develops during adolescence. And one kind of positive element of that research is that the brain remains highly plastic for many years, right throughout adolescence into the 20s. So in other words, we shouldn't give up on young people who have missed a huge amount of their education and their learning. So if they've completely switched off during this period, even if this period ends up being really quite a lot of months or more, that doesn't mean that we should give up on those people. They still have the capacity to catch up and to learn. Their brains are more plastic than an adult brain, although adult brains are plastic to a certain extent too. The brain is capable of really efficient learning during adolescence and change. It's not going to be too late for those children, as long as the right strategies are in place for enabling and facilitating them to catch up.
Do you think this is an opportunity to rethink education, rethink curriculums, rethink the way schools are operating?
I think that the big factor in here, I don't want to repeat the stuff about inequalities because they'll apply. But I think the other factor that's going to be really important is the length of these periods of time when we're in either relative isolation and out of conventional schooling. If it does end up being just a few weeks, then we perhaps are in a position where we can go back into normal schooling within a year or two. If this extends or is a repeated break, then we're going to have to radically rethink how we educate young people. And we can't know for sure yet which of those we're going into. So there's a huge amount of kind of tentativeness in making any predictions about that.
We need to rethink what education is all about and whether, and at the moment, our education system involves a lot of cramming of information, content, and a lot of testing. Now, if people miss out a whole chunk of schooling, and that also is very unequal across the population, so some children are missing out much more than others, then maybe forcing them to try to learn lots of content and testing them on it is not the most fair way to go forward from now with our education system, at least temporarily.
I think there is a real opportunity actually to think a lot more about, more generally, about what education is for and how it works and how we operate it.
Should we be worried about the lack of peer contact that students have right now? And are there lessons from homeschooling at other times and other, that can be applied to our current situation?
What we can take from home learning is interesting. But it's challenging to move that directly across because they're a very highly self-selected group of people who homeschool. So there's probably some stuff we can learn in terms of social integration later, but it'll be very confounded by that.
I work on social interaction, the importance of social interaction, peer-to-peer learning, that kind of thing in education. So taking young people out, and particularly in secondary school education, taking young people out of the classroom, I mean, I guess it depends for how long. A short removal from the classroom, a short shutdown might have very little effect, but any longer term shutdown could start to have effects and we just don't know. But one thing I would like to say is that there are huge individual differences, and something I have, and this is anecdotal, but something I have read about recently, and it makes complete sense, is that classrooms are not the positive environment that we think they are for all children. I mean, some children, you know, thrive on peer-to-peer learning and being around their friends. Others, for example, children who are being bullied or children who find school environments really stressful, do not thrive in that environment with 30 kids in a class. And I say this because I read a report from, I think it was Barnardo's a couple of weeks ago, interviewing a few young people who are delighted not to have to go into school every day, because for them, school is an extremely stressful environment because of bullying. And again, that makes me think, you know, this is a good opportunity to, I expect every country in the world will go back to schooling as it has been for the last 400 years after this lockdown. But this is an opportunity to rethink things radically.
So we know that teenagers are very sensitive to the opinions of their peers. Can we use those peer influences in positive ways?
It's something that I that ties in with what I was saying right at the beginning of this discussion on the power of peer influence in adolescence. There was a study published a few years ago on anti-bullying interventions in schools, in middle schools in America. So these are schools for 11 to 15 year olds. They worked with 56 schools. They divided the schools randomly into two groups. One group carried out their anti-bullying campaigns as normal, led by the teachers. And in the other half of the schools, a select group of students in each year group was chosen to run their own anti-bullying campaign. So they were educated about the harmful effects of bullying and social exclusion. And then they were incentivized to run their own campaigns. They could do that in whatever way they like parties, debates, wristband campaigns, all sorts of things. They just decided how to do it themselves, these students in their schools. And what the results showed was that over the following year, the schools in which the anti-bullying campaigns were led by the students had a 25% reduction in bullying incidents and social exclusion incidents compared with the control schools where the anti-bullying campaigns were led by teachers. And the schools in which this showed the strongest effects were where the students who were leading the campaigns were the most connected, highly connected and liked students. In other words, there are some students who have even more influence on other people than other students. And that's just one example, very clear cut result. It's also been shown for anti-smoking campaigns and healthy eating as well. And there's no reason why that couldn't be taken online and also across age groups. So it wouldn't necessarily have to be, you know, 15-year-olds influencing each other. It could be 17-year-olds influencing 15-year-olds in positive ways.
What about intergenerational role modelling?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. The importance of adult role models, I think, is something that is easily neglected, and it's actually something that I think is being neglected in the current large numbers of research projects being done on the effect of social distancing on mental health and behaviour and learning. They are really focusing on the social distancing from peers rather than from adult mentors. But it is something that is really important. In the context of low middle income countries, a study I saw presented recently had an intervention that involved adult role models, young, you know, older sisters or young aunties, young women friends of families, trying to encourage girls to stay in school and not to leave school to get married. And that had positive outcomes over the ensuing couple of years. So fewer girls got married and more remained in school. So there is such an important role to play for adults in young people's lives, particularly, I think, in our country, but also in other countries like low middle income countries.
I also wondered if you think sort of gender is, you know, gender relations in terms of, you know, childhood and kind of parenting, whether we can expect those to be changing under the current circumstances.
In terms of gender relationships within families, I guess it's going to vary like all of these things enormously, but one of the big shifts is going to be both parents potentially being back at home in lots of families at the moment. And it's difficult to predict how that will play out because it will be enormously variable, but it will have impacts on parenting and it will have impacts on the children's experiences of parenting.
What should we be thinking about in terms of how the pandemic and social isolation is going to be impacting on young people in developing world contexts?
I don't have direct experience of that situation. So I guess the only two general things I would think about, obviously the priority has to be to try and get infection under control as quickly as possible, so as what passes for normal life can resume as quickly as possible. But the other would be to think about and try and find some way of assessing the needs of these young people, because it's difficult for me sitting where I sit to predict what they might be in that particular situation. In terms of education and trying to get their education right, certainly. So it would be thinking about it comes back to this idea about children and young people's voice a bit as well. Trying to be able to gather information from them or find out what it is that they need or what they're missing. And then design programs, hopefully in collaboration with international agencies, if they're there, to meet some of those needs. That's a very general answer, I appreciate, but it's a very difficult context for me to kind of put myself in the shoes of.
Finally, what about older adolescents? Do we need to be concerned about the impact of the pandemic on their rites of passage, on how they're going to be navigating their journey to adulthood?
Across the world, rites of passage happen at different times and ages, and I don't think there's, you know, any particularly right or wrong age at which children need to go through these rites of passage. It just depends on their culture, but it's the uncertainty. They are at least in this culture, they are at the pivotal moment in their lives where they go from living at home to becoming independent adults, and suddenly there's a whole load of uncertainty around that. Will they be able to, you know, travel on their gap year next year? Will they be able to go to universities and live independently for the first time? And I think it's not actually the whether they will be able to or not, because different cultures do things differently and different individuals do things differently. It's really the uncertainty, I think, and there's quite a lot of evidence that uncertainty is very hard for many people to live with. Certainty, even of something negative, is easier on us than uncertainty of what things will look like.
Can some amount of uncertainty be good for character development?
Okay, so I'm going to slightly change the question, which is a great question, and there are probably very big individual differences on how much certainty people or uncertainty people can live with and how much uncertainty is positive versus negative. In terms of adolescence, one analogous concept is risk-taking. And how much risk-taking, I haven't even mentioned the word risk-taking yet, really, except right at the beginning in the context of peer influence, but risk-taking, as we know, heightened in adolescence. And there's some argument that we need to allow adolescents to take a certain number of risks, kind of educated risks, because risk-taking is really important for learning, for exploring the environment, for becoming independent. You need to take some risks. You need to learn by trial and error. And that's where uncertainty comes in. That is what risk-taking is. It's making a decision or an action without being certain of the consequences of that action. That's what risk-taking is. And although risk-taking can go wrong and can be dangerous, actually a certain level of risk-taking is really important for all of us at all ages, but particularly during the period of adolescence when young people need to forge their own identities and become independent adults.
Thank you to Sarah, Jane and Paul for this fascinating discussion. And thank you for joining us.
CSAP Science and Policy Podcast is a production of the Center for Science and Policy at the University of Cambridge. This series, Science, Policy and Pandemics, has been produced in partnership with Cambridge Infectious Diseases and the Cambridge Immunology Network. This episode was hosted by Dr. Rob Doubleday and produced by me, Kate McNeil. Our guests this week were Professor Sarah Jane Blakemore and Professor Paul Ramchandani. You can learn more about CSAP's work by visiting us on Twitter at CSIPaul or by visiting our website at www.csap.cam.ac.uk. If you have feedback about this episode or questions you'd like us to address in a future week, please email inquiries@csap.cam.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.